A Pulitzer Prize winning opera goes from artistic archive to stage spotlight. From SDPB, today is Tuesday, April 15th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we preview the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra's performance of Giants in the Earth. We welcome Maestro Delta David Geyer for a look at how notations on a page became the orchestra's historic offering to Midwestern art, culture, and storytelling. Then we dig deeper into the story itself with Craig Howe. We'll talk about things that separated the Norwegian settlers from the people who had already built a society on the plains. Plus, 250 years after a massive Norwegian migration began, we check in with Lutherans today for a look at how they are handling the legacy of their ancestors. That's coming later in the hour. We are broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're In the Moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Imagine you are standing in the archives of a library, a stack of documents on the table. Thousands of individual notations represent music, sharp and flat, crescendo and decrescendo. You see before you an opera on the page. Virtually no one living has heard this opera performed. What will it sound like? You've been told it will sound like America. The South Dakota Symphony Orchestra brings the Pulitzer Prize-winning opera Giants in the Earth to the stage April 26th and 27th in the Great Hall at the Washington Pavilion in Sioux Falls. This fall, SDPB brings the production to public television. Yesterday, we spent an hour learning about Ole Rolvag, the author of the book Giants in the Earth. Today, we focus on the opera, and we get responses from people who are new to the story as we consider the impact of giants. Maestro Delta David Geyer opened his home to SDPB. We sat near his piano, and I asked him when he first heard about the opera.
My first year here in South Dakota, and Art Husebo, who was the founder of the Center for Western Studies in Augustana, he gave me a copy of the book, Giants in the Earth, and he said, and you know, there's an opera. And I'm thinking, you know, what, Grand Old Opry, I don't know what he's talking about. So I finally got around to reading the book. Unfortunately, he had passed by the time I got around to that. But then I researched the opera, and lo and behold, not only an opera, but by Douglas Moore, who's a very well-known and respected mid-20th century American opera composer. And it won the Pulitzer Prize in 1951. And it was performed at Columbia in 51. And then one other time in Grand Forks, North Dakota, sometime in the 70s. But other than that, not performed at all and never recorded. So I keep referring to this as finding a diamond on the side of the road.
I find a review of the original performance that was kind of lackluster. Do you think their performance of it was good? Why would it not catch hold in the American psyche as an American-made piece of music?
Well, Douglas Moore's big opera was Ballad of Baby Doe, and it did exactly that. I mean, it really took America by storm. So that's why I say he was a very well-known opera composer. Nobody seems to know exactly what the problem was. I think it had to do perhaps with the Rolvag estate, perhaps with copyright. Something like that had to do with it. It's a puzzlement.
So why now? Why stage the opera now?
Well, we've been talking about it for years and years, and I guess the fact is that we got funding to do it finally. So that was sort of the key to unlock, you know, that now's the time.
What needed to happen to bring it to the stage?
I ordered the perusal scores from the publisher. It took me quite a while to track it down, which publisher, where did this material reside. And I got this huge box of scores, all in manuscript. And then I spent another, you know, a series of months trying to track down an archival recording from that original production in the 50s. I went to Columbia, and they told me it was at Library of Congress. The Library of Congress then said, no, it's definitely at Columbia. Finally tracked it down and got this absolutely wretched recording I mean, the performance itself was not very good. So it's a miracle that it won the Pulitzer Prize anyway. But also the quality of the recording was not good. Yeah. So, but it was enough to, you know, to get a sense of this opera. I mean, and it's a really a full blown American opera.
Is the prize awarded not on the performance, is it? Or is it? Is the prize awarded on the score for music?
The Pulitzer Prize is given to a piece of music that has been premiered within the last year. So it has nothing really to do with the performance, right. Only to do with the score itself.
So 1951. What's happening in America when this is premiered?
Douglas Moore was actually right at the center of us trying to find our American musical identity. So right in there with Aaron Copland and Leonard Bernstein, he was the head of the music department at Columbia University, just right at the forefront of that. And everything that he wrote had to do with Americana. He really believed in finding an American voice in classical music. So this fits perfectly within that.
As you go through the perusal scores in manuscript form, tell mm-hmm. us exactly what that means. It's not...
It's all scribbles everywhere, yeah.
His scribbles?
His scribbles, yes.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Sometimes clear, sometimes not so much.
So how do you approach that? How do you approach trying to figure out his intentions? You only have one very poor recording and his scribbles. Mm-hmm. That gives you a lot of choice, decisions?
What fits musically can be usually deciphered, you know, among the choices. Is that an A flat or is it a B flat? Is it, you know, like you can, but it takes careful attention to figure that out. And that was the engraving process brings that to the fore where, you know, you actually need to create, you know, materials for the orchestra to play from. And, you know, they can't all be playing from this chicken scratch. Obviously, they did at the premiere in 1951, but no professional orchestra is going to do that today. So we had to go through that process. And in that process, all those details came to the fore.
Is it like a book in translation that whoever is doing the translation is very influential in how this is going to sound? Is that you? Is that someone who did the engraving?
Unfortunately, it's me. I say unfortunately because I never fancied myself an editor. But of course, my whole life is given over towards trying to bring to life a piece of music with the composer's intent. It's not my stamp on a Beethoven symphony, for example. It's, you know, trying to get to what Beethoven was after. Same way as, you know, somebody directing a play of Shakespeare. Like, you know, are you going to mess with it? Are you going to do silly things with it? Or are you really trying to get to the intent of the author? I had a lot of decisions to make, and Ann Waltner, our symphony pianist, was absolutely integral to this process. She sat here, right here with me for hours and hours and going through the score together. And, well, no, he can't have meant that. It must have been this because it was this way over here. And, you know, that was an arduous process.
So are there moments then where it just clicks into place and you say, that sounds right? That.
Yeah, right. And it's not so easy because Douglas Moore's musical language is actually quite unique to him. I mean, there's major and minor tonalities in there, but boy, his harmony is, it's hard to pin it down exactly what it doesn't sound like Copland. It doesn't sound like, it certainly doesn't sound like Beethoven. So it's, but you know, you start to get into his world and into his sound world and into his harmonic language, and it becomes easier to make those decisions. Like I say, you can compare and contrast similar passages of music and say, okay, well, this is really, we know this is what he meant. So this looks a little squirrely, but it really would fit this very well. So let's make this decision.
Does it sound like America?
Yeah, absolutely. It sounds like America from the get-go. Like the opening measures of it sound, you can hear the openness of the prairie and the loneliness of the prairie. And that music keeps coming back through the opera, particularly around the central character of Barrett, who's wrestling with so many issues. but loneliness being one of them. And it's a very American sounding, open kind of plains kind of sound. Yeah.
So it's an American immigrant experience of loneliness on the prairie, to be specific.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
So with your work with the Lakota Music Project, you wouldn't necessarily assume that an indigenous musician would hear the same loneliness in the prairie. They might hear something entirely different. And you're hearing Barrett. You're hearing the characters from the story is what mm-hmm. I'm getting at.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the characters in the story and their experience that ends up being part of the opera.
Yeah, well, I think Rolvag does a wonderful job of you know, delineating what these people went through as immigrants, as homesteaders. I was just in New York doing an event for Giants in the Earth, and you know, was running into some older generation people saying, yeah, I remember this was required reading in our, you know, New England prep school. You know, like it was the American immigrant story 100 years ago. There was none other like it at the time. So Rolvag really, really encapsulated that experience. Then Douglas Moore translating that into music also, I think, absolutely masterfully is the other side of that coin. The way that he composed, I mean, that we have stories from his family of him in his home on Long Island with the libretto that was created from the book, just pacing around the house for days and weeks, reciting the text. And he was looking for rhythm to set the text, but he was also looking for inflection. So the melodic lines also came out of the text, you know, just the reciting of the text. And it becomes this very organic, flowing kind of a way of composing. And then he adds the harmony to that, you know, and it colors the whole thing, sets the whole scene. Is it dark? Is it happy? Is it, you know, the rhythms, are they dancing, or is it brooding? Is it like, he just runs the full gamut of it, but he brings each of these characters to life with their own music.
This is a composer who, through the entirety of a novel, wrote an opera about a place that wasn't necessarily deeply connected to him because he wanted American music to continue to be built out mm-hmm. in the arts space. Am I telling a story that's not really
no,
the story?
I think you're tapping into it there. I mean, you know, look at Aaron Copland. I mean, he kind of coined the sound of the American West in his music. He's a Jewish kid from Brooklyn. You know, how did he do that? You know, these ballets and orchestral pieces, Appalachian Spring, a rodeo, like, you know, but yet he was able to really, you know, create this American sound.
Yeah. So I want to get to what's going to happen, you know, at the performance here and some of that journey up to that point. But I also want to talk about New York and you going there and premiering some of this music in places that have never heard it before, excerpts of it. Tell me a little bit about that journey, if you would.
Well, the New York connection goes back to Columbia University and spending some hours in the university library. Like I say, I got the manuscript scores from the publisher, but there was all this extant material that was held at Columbia University. So you make an appointment and they pull out all these boxes of, you know, and it's librettos and piano vocal scores and all these things. So I spent hours and days there at Columbia University doing that and, you know, finding as much material as I could. There's an organization called the Douglas Moore Fund. It's a misnomer because it's not like they're doling out a lot of money, but like a Douglas Moore Society. It's, you know, specifically for the promotion of Douglas Moore's works, but more broadly, American opera. We've been partnering with them through this whole process, and they wanted to have an event in New York City that would preview this this opera. So we did that at the Scandinavian House and in the Victor Borge Hall, and using Victor Borge's own piano. But we had two singers, the two leads, Barrett and Pear, and a pianist and myself. And we did five excerpts of their, some arias, some scenes between the two of them. And the stage director, Bob New, was also there. So we talked about, you know, unearthing the opera and the bit of the story behind the opera. And then we sang excerpts. And yeah, it's the first time this music had been heard in New York for 75 years. Mm-hmm. So they, you know, the audience was absolutely delighted. It's always a bit of a relief when they actually hear some of this music, you know, coming alive, because it's like, yeah, it's, I hope it's a great opera, you know, after all this work. And it is. But there's a bit of faith involved.
Yeah. All right. Talk to us about what goes into the orchestra's production. Who's coming? Is it a fully staged opera? What's the experience going to be like for the audience?
It's a full-length opera, three acts. We auditioned over 100 singers for the roles, and there are 10 roles, and we got our top pick of those people who auditioned. Very excited about that. And they'll come in 2 weeks before the performance, and we'll start with musical rehearsals with a pianist and staging rehearsals throughout that first week. And then we'll add the orchestra during the second week, the week of the production itself. The audience will come and they'll experience not just the music, but also what we call a semi-staged production, which means the orchestra is still on stage rather than being in the pit. But there will be everybody, all the singers will be memorized. They'll be in costume. They'll be staged fully interacting as they would in a regular opera, and some minimal sets and props. We've done 7 or 8 other operas this way, and the audience really, really loves, you know, having the orchestra on stage and being part of the action.
Yeah. What's the story?
It's the story of the very first Norwegian immigrants to this part of the country, to eastern South Dakota, near to Sioux Falls, actually. So at the beginning of the book and the opera, you have two couples that are part of a community that have been here already, and they're waiting for this other family to come. And these are the main characters who arrive early on in that first act, and it's Per Hansa and his wife Berit. They embody the struggles that that went into building a community. But the thing that is front and center of the story is the love that this couple has for one another. Per Hansa is a very headstrong man. He's ready to build an empire, you know. And Berit, her heart is still in the old country. She's not sure that she should be here. She's following her husband. She loves him dearly. She's that woman who wants so much to hold on to the traditions, the religion of their family. And she comes and she sees that we're losing it already here. And this is the story of the other two books after Giants in the Earth. The trilogy is really Barrett becoming the pillar of this community, and then her children separating. It's a story of any immigrants, you know, the second generation wants to pull off and become American, you know. And in this opera, you get the conflict between the husband and wife, the husband who wants to build something, the wife who's trying to hold on to something of the past, and honestly feeling like we can't stay, we need to go home. That's at the core of the opera. The other two couples are very integral to the plot as well, and they they fill out the story with, yes, the struggle of being homesteaders, but also a lot of comedy, a lot of fun, you know, drinking songs and spinning songs and things like this throughout. The larger community also plays somewhat of a role. Our symphony chorus will be involved. And crazy thing, the first thing they do when they all gather together on the prairie in that first act is they sing the Norwegian national anthem in Norwegian. Thank you very much. Just in case you wonder where we came from. There's a big fight scene with some Irish homesteaders that are trying to steal some land. And, you know, the men go for a trip to the big city, Sioux Falls, to get supplies, you know, this kind of thing as well. In the end, there's a baby that's born, Barrett's third child. There's a whole dedication baptism ceremony that takes place, but the child falls ill. And at the end of the story, the child is in danger of dying, and Barrett is beside herself that she needs a preacher. Basically forces her husband to go out in the midst of a blizzard to go fetch this preacher to come bless the child before it dies. And in the very last scene, she realizes what she's done, that she's sent her husband out on a suicidal mission. And he's not coming back. And she kind of becomes the picture of the homesteading woman who goes crazy, you know, out on the prairie. And that's the tragedy. That's the end of the opera and the end of the first book.
Yeah. So grief, loss.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's an opera. It's everything. Yeah.
What is the relationship between your work with the Lakota Music Project and your work with this opera?
Well, I've wrestled with that a lot. How can we be the orchestra that does Lakota Music Project and do this opera about people coming and taking the land? And I mean, both of them are part of our history. You know, it's like there's no, in my mind, no sense ignoring one part of the history in favor of another part of the history. And of course, the history is very complex. You talk with people on both sides of that issue, and you'll get a lot of different stories of relationships between the Lakota and the first settlers who came here. What's our responsibility as a symphony orchestra is what it always is, and that's to present art. To present art that's good, to present art that is relevant to our community. And I think this opera very much does that. The Lakota Music Project is also equally, if not more important to do, because it raises awareness of arguably the most important culture of our state. It builds a bridge between our two cultures, helps us to understand one another by the sharing of music of both of our cultures. So I see these two projects as sort of two tracks, but parallel and both important and both relevant to who we are and what we do.
In conversation with one another.
In conversation with one another, yes. To that point, in Rolvag's novel, there's not much about the Dakota. There is one, just remembering my own memory, one very poignant scene between one of the Norwegian settlers and a Dakota man. And it's a good scene. It's not a scene of conflict. That scene, unfortunately, does not make it into the opera. There is in the opera a bone that's found. Barrett questions whether it's an antelope bone, and Sievert says, no, it's Indian. She's very disturbed by this. And it's interesting because it becomes part of her reason for thinking that we're wrong to be here. We should go back home. It's not just a momentary thing. The bone itself, at least in her inner dialogue, comes back later in the opera. So it's she's in existential crisis, this woman, over, you know, where she is and how they're settling this area.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. For people who are descended from this you know, this story of immigration, what does art reflect to us? You know, you have the moment that you described, it might reflect a pride in singing the Norwegian national anthem. It might reflect a grief and suffering of how much your ancestors, the price they paid to do the thing, that it might induce someone to feel new thoughts of what went wrong, or shame even. It might induce all these feelings that are going to stir the heart in a great piece of art. What's the role of art in bringing up these complicated feelings that we have and reflecting them back to us?
Well, I think you just answered your own question. I mean, that is the role of art, to bring these things up. And what we do with those feelings and those thoughts is up to us. What we hope to engender in people is the best in us, that music can bring forth the best in us, and can help us to aspire to, yes, to better relations, but to doing the right thing. You know, I'm not a Norwegian immigrant myself, but what's the right thing to do now? You know, where we are now in this situation, and how can we be in dialogue with one another, in meaningful dialogue, in productive dialogue with each other across these racial divides and cultural divides, in such a way that we can forge a way forward that lifts us both up, you know, that restores what has been lost, that builds on what has been built, you know. And I would hope that a story like Giants of the Earth, a project like Lakota Music Project, would engender that hope, that those aspirations.
Maestro Delta David Geyer is music director and conductor of the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The South Dakota Symphony Orchestra brings the Pulitzer Prize-winning opera Giants in the Earth to the stage April 26th and 27th in the Great Hall at the Washington Pavilion in Sioux Falls. This fall, SDPB brings the production to public television. Now, we wanted to dig deeper into Giants in the Earth and what it means to look at the story today and from different perspectives. We asked Craig Howe with the Center for American Indian Research and Native Studies if he'd be willing to read the book and share his thoughts. Dr. Howe checked with the Bennett County Library and found a copy. The SDPB crew drove to Martin to meet with him at his home at Wing Springs. And I asked him to explore a few of the themes that really stuck with him after reading the book.
Capitalism, that's just so strong in my mind, this idea of capitalism and just that process of colonizing and implementing capitalism, whether it's over a sea or of water or in a sea of grass, maybe it's some of those same processes play out. Oh, and another aspect is religion, and how religion, you know, it's just so shocking, or the role that religion plays in that novel, multiple ways, in positive ways and in extremely deadly ways. The actors, with the best of intentions, you know, in the end, there they end up killing two people, one person, the main character, because of religion. And it's hard, you know, but these are the realities, I think, of religion and capitalism and how those go together. And this is worldwide, it's not just here. And then more personal, maybe, or not personal, but say tied to time and place, is I thought the representation of American Indians in the novel were about the best I've seen in a long time from a non-native writer. They're not afraid of them. Some of them are afraid, but all the representations of the American Indians, or I shouldn't say all of them, I'd have to reread it real finely, but they're treated as human beings. And that's sometimes that's all we're asking, right? Just treat American Indians like human beings and be truthful. There, you don't hear anything about an Indian killing anyone in that whole novel. And that's how it was. South Dakota was a territory for about 20 years, from 62 to 89, 30 years almost. And we tried to find all the accounts where American Indians killed non-Indians in that 30-year period from the newspapers in Dakota Territory, and we could find none. So this novel, set in the 1870s, right in the middle of that territory period, they don't mention anything. And the main character, he goes and trades with the Santees. And the amazing thing is, he's talking about these Santees, and they're the ones who were forced out of Minnesota after the Minnesota War in 1862, and they were located in Santee, Nebraska, where there's a Santee reservation today. And in the late 60s, they rescinded their tribal reservation. They left their reservation and had to give up those rights, and they went to where Flandreau is now, and they homesteaded there. The same thing Per and those Norwegians are doing. These Santees, they did the same thing. They went up there to Flandreau and started and bought their land and farmed, and now that's a reservation, and that's a federally recognized tribe, but it wasn't at that time. Per, of course, he has to go there and trade with them, and he makes money off of it, and they make money. I mean, it's just business. Per was just open to that. And not just open, he realized he needed help. You know, he had to get going, and he was behind his other four countrymen. He was always just from the back working, trying to catch up, but he was clever. In a positive sense, not in a negative sense. He just used all the resources he could to do the best he could, and he did amazing.
When I've been talking to people about this book and the story, some words come up again and again of isolation, desolation, loneliness, a brutal landscape, a very difficult landscape to make a living on or make a life in. And it always strikes me when I hear that and read it in the book, their experience is one of overwhelm and fear.
All the native peoples here, this was their sacred land. It's not in the Middle East. This is the sacred place. This is where all their ancestors came from. It's fundamentally different than everyone else in North America. Their sacred lands and their spiritual traditions go back to somewhere in the East. Sacred land, home. This is all they knew. They weren't lonely, it's all they knew. One reason it might be lonely for those main five families or individuals that's not a society. These were a few friends maybe, but they didn't live in a structured, they didn't all travel together. They did when they had to, but we can see that from the women's side a lot of times. They're staying in their houses that are scattered in 160-acre plots, right? So there's forced isolation by this homesteading process. Whereas when the American Indians are mentioned, they're traveling through as a group, and they're living together, and everything as a community, they're moving, and they're intergenerational. Now, in these homesteaders, there are these intergenerational, but there is the oldest generation, and it's middle age, and then it goes younger. Whereas in the native communities, it's everything from that very youngest, the babies, all the way to the oldest. So I think that was a big part of it.
Yeah, and Barrett, the wife, is very much feeling the loss of community, the loss of language, the loss of tradition.
Yeah, it started right from the very beginning. She was already, when they were just themselves in that wagon, she was already, it seemed like, having those issues. Like on the American Indian viewpoint, are these, especially the more mobile people, like out here in the West, then you move around and you might move as a family, but there always were these, the whole year was structured to coalesce and individualize, coalesce and individualize. It was just part of the structure. Yeah. I guess they did coalesce like with the once there was a priest, right? So you have this religion that has to bring them back together where they would work together a little bit with the harvesting. But it was that religious and it's really limited to 2 hours or 3 hours or whatever it is.
Yeah. And that's the moment where they feel like a community. Yes. They have the communion, then they have the religious leader.
And the baptisms.
And the baptism, yeah.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. Is there anything else from the book that now that you've read it, that you would recommend people who are going to see the opera and they say, well, now I'm done, I want to process it, think about it from different perspectives. How are we to come at pieces of art that are really about a complicated topic and then do the work afterwards to say, well, there's more to this than that?
I mean, of course, there's a lot that we can talk about. Sometimes I like to think about works of art without having to give all the background or the backstory as far as appreciate it as a work of art. And in the case of American Indians, for instance, I think there's like three times American Indians are mentioned. And then they're mentioned this burial on that land when they first get there. There is a burial on that land. So there's that mentioned first, and then there's the people moving through there because this was the path they would travel. And then we have the people at Flandreau. So I think taking note of how they are mentioned. And as I recall, they're mentioned, as I mentioned earlier, just as human beings. I mean, they're not mentioned in the derogatory or the fear-mongering ways that a lot of that type of literature does. If you're interested in a little bit of that backstory, this land that's being homesteaded was just acquired by the United States in 1858, so 14 years before that, through treaty with the Yankton Sioux tribe. And it was like a whole bunch of land that the Yankton Sioux tribe ceded to the United States and reserved for themselves, basically what's Charles Mix County today.
Okay.
So that was fresh in these Yankton's mind, and that's probably those people who were traveling through that pair helped the guy who had the infection in his hand. Those were most likely Yanktons, maybe Santians, but Yanktons probably. And it was just their traditional route. This was their traditional land. They had only known that land as theirs. And then in 1853, this treaty was signed and it was transferred to the United States. And then it was open for homesteading in 1862. So though that's kind of the immediate backstory to how this land was there for free for immigrants, not for American Indians. Those Santians who wanted to that land, they had to do the same process and give up their reservation and go to Flandreau and homestead, and they did, and they're still there. And whereas only about 40% of the immigrant homesteaders stuck. So more successful, the native homesteaders by far, but a smaller, examples.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for reading the book with us.
I enjoyed it. I really did, but it still sticks with me.
Yeah.
Now it's been 2 weeks since I read it, and it still sometimes, I don't know if bother is the right word, but just really, and sad isn't get it either, but there's just, I like kind of that idea, dark, I don't know why all that, but it's hard sometimes to think about it.
Yeah. Special thanks to Craig Howe with the Center for American Indian Research and Native Studies, otherwise known as Cairns, for reading Giants in the Earth with us. Now, he mentioned the impact of religion in the story. We wanted to know more about that. So we reached out to Bishop Constanza Hegmeyer with the ELCA for her insight. That's coming up after the break. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We are working through the story of Giants in the Earth ahead of the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra's performance of the opera later this month. Let's turn now to the Reverend Constanza Hagmeier, Bishop of the South Dakota Synod Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. She ministers to the faith families that grew from the seeds of immigrant settlers. Many of these churches find their numbers waning today here in America, 250 years after the launch of one of the world's most impactful migrations. Bishop Hagmeier is also an immigrant from Germany. We met her in her office, housed in the chapel of Augustana University in Sioux Falls.
We talk a lot about, especially in with minority cultures, about trauma. And my wonderment, and I'm exploring this personally as I minister now in a wider context, and as I observe my parents aging, promises that have been made in the past and trauma that has been passed down. So as you ask me about what was it like and how does this still live on, I think there is a narrative, especially now that we start celebrating centennial anniversaries, 125th, 150th, 175th anniversaries in churches, they work through the stories, right, of their own narrative, their congregation's narrative, and now other generations encounter generations past and the hardships. And I would say, as much as we want to live that up as like a heroic story, we need to be careful about this settler narrative, because especially in the cost of free land, in that book it becomes very prevalent, as the author writes about, there was a cost to this. And somehow that cost, that trauma, that sadness, that grief, that struggle, is God angry with me? Why am I here? Why did I get to be put here? And I myself have struggled with that when we, you know, have hard days as being an immigrant, and my husband and I are looking at ourselves and saying, what were we thinking? Right? Why did we come here? This is so hard. That gets passed down through generations, whether it is through promises made, right? Make sure that this church will never go away. And now you have made a promise on deathbed. That church will be here. And so letting go seems like betrayal to a generation that had given everything, right? They had nothing when they came here, and they give everything to build the church, dug the field stones up with their own hands. And now we're closing this community of faith. Are we betraying our ancestors? If we want to continue the legacy of faith, is it about being tied to that building? Or is it about being tied to the commitment to the Christian faith, which gave our ancestors an anchor in a time when they felt lost?
From the immigrant settler point of view, what is our responsibility to look at the harm that was also done, not just the things that we collectively survived and endured, but also in doing so caused and perpetuated?
I think the unique gift that we have is that we can work on reconciliation, and that we don't need to be making it about you and me, but about us in Christ, and that we don't have to approach this work with guilt and shame, but that we can confess and hope that in faith and through the power of the gospel and hope beyond death, and it's not just death one day, it's death each and every moment.
What are some of the ways we can frame this conversation to help us understand one another and understand what we want America to be?
We can only be doing this if we do it together. I can't tell you how many times, the first year, I can probably frame it, the first year, coming as a white immigrant to a white community, granted, mostly they were Norwegian, I was German. At that point, you could really still see the differences 26 years ago. I can't tell you how many nights I spent crying on the dinner table. I was afraid to have people over for coffee, or granted, they would probably want to ask me to have a treat, right? You serve in a rural community. There's always some lunch involved. I didn't even know what the basic things were. I didn't know what Fahrenheit was. I was used to Celsius. I don't know what the stuff on the grocery shelf is. Again, here's my Crisco story. I don't know what Crisco is. Somebody teach me, help me understand. There's tons of, it's overwhelming. This country can be so overwhelming. And day to day, what seems ordinary now, open enrollment, your kids in school. I mean, and I spoke English. My husband didn't speak English. Where do you insure your car? Who can you trust to buy a car? It's just mind-boggling. Your child has a fever. Where do you go? How do you get care? Who pays for it? How do I pay for it? How do I explain what my child... I mean, just little things. How do I pump gas? I don't even know. Buy a bus ticket. Is there a bus? How do I get from A to B? It's the little things. And if we would have not had a community to support us, I don't know. I don't know where we would be. I mean, there were literally people sitting down with my husband every day teaching him English. When I was an exchange student, the gift to me was that my host mother was a special ed teacher. So every night she did what she would do during the day with a special ed student she had in school. The success really comes if we pay attention and not become this homogeneous us versus them. Because in essence, we all want to be loved and we all want someone to love. And life can be overwhelming. So when we pass each other in the street, we don't know each other's story. And it's really in the sharing of the story. We have been greeted with such an overwhelming amount of warmth because we look like the rest of the people. And it's now our time to welcome everyone, regardless of where we come from. Again, it's this humility and curiousness. What's your story? Right? There's a poem that I picked up at one of the galas for Voices for Peace. And I don't know the author, I have it on my phone, but it's titled, there is a line in there that always speaks to me that we need to keep in mind. No one would leave home if home wouldn't be in the mouth of a shark. It's a long poem. But no one would leave home if home wouldn't be in the mouth of a shark, right? We have to remember that. No one would just up and go because it's so much fun to leave everything that you love and treasure behind. But people leave or forced into leaving because it's not safe where they are.
That is Bishop Constanza Hagmeier with the South Dakota Synod of the ELCA. You can find the latest edition of Ole Rahlvag's novel, Giants in the Earth, through the South Dakota State Historical Society Press. The South Dakota Symphony Orchestra presents Giants in the Earth, the opera, later this month. We will put links up to everything on our website, sdpb.org. And that is our show for today. We hope that it served you from all of us at SDPB. Thank you for listening.